From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on the morning of Independence Day, last Tuesday. You see, NPR has made a tradition of reading the entire Declaration of Independence on Morning Edition. And so for the 29th consecutive year, they did. But this time, NPR's Twitter feed also tweeted the entire declaration. Given the constraints of Twitter, it required more than 100 tweets to do so. Many Twitter users applauded NPR for tweeting this historic document, but then something strange started to happen. Some Twitter users attacked NPR, not understanding what they were reading. They thought that NPR was showing some kind of political bias, some kind of anti-Trump slant, by tweeting nothing but the actual words in the American Declaration of Independence. NPR had offended a slew of Trump supporters, all of which was surprising to some of us, but maybe it shouldn't be. And this is not just an epidemic under the current administration. After all, a 2012 study out of Xavier University found that one in three American citizens could not pass a naturalization test. And yes, immigrants do much better on tests when it comes to American history. So what are we teaching students anyway? And how can those numbers change? What are the questions on the test? And how would you fare? We'll talk about that. We'll have a bit of a quiz for you coming up here. Let me go ahead and welcome our guest for the hour. Michael Oberg is a distinguished professor of history at SUNY Geneseo. Welcome back to the program, Professor.
Thank you, Evan.
Evie Fanning is a local high school English teacher who went through this process yourself about 20 years ago, yes?
Right.
What's the brief background there?
I was a political refugee from the former Soviet Union, and having lived here without any citizenship at all, after several years, had to take the test and swear the oath and be naturalized.
And you remember it pretty well.
I remember it pretty well.
Well, we'll have a lot to talk about there. Samuel Bovard is a 7th and 8th grade ESOL and ELA teacher in the Rochester City School District. Samuel, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Kevin Maywison is Associate Professor of Teaching and Curriculum, a Social Studies Education Scholar, and Director of Teacher Education for the Warner School of Education at the University of Rochester. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Professor Oberg, I'm going to start with you and just ask you if this whole episode with NPR and the Declaration of Independence, did it surprise you at all?
Unfortunately, it didn't surprise me. A similar thing took place in 1976 to celebrate the bicentennial. And for those of who were alive in 1976, I remember as a kid, sort of this orgy of self-congratulatory nonsense about patriotism and all that. And students asked mallgoers to sign a petition with the declaration, and most of them refused to do so. So, no, it's not. Most Americans know nothing of the declaration. We know a few lines out of the preamble, nothing of the grievances that really are or were at the time the heart of the document and the important part of the document. Not surprising at all.
And here are some of the tweets that came NPR's way that got the attention just of the Washington Post, for example. Probably the most famous was a woman named D.G. Davies who says, she said that NPR is calling for revolution. Interesting way to condone the violence while trying to sound patriotic. Your implications are clear. To her credit, by the way, later she did say, I tweeted something very dumb. But ask yourself, if read to the average American, would they know that they were reading the Declaration of Independence? So she was, Professor Oberg, she was defending herself on the grounds that, okay, maybe I thought this was an anti-Trump screed from NPR, but how many of us have actually read the Declaration, which is sort of an indictment in and of itself?
Yeah, I noticed all the patriotic T-shirts around when I was traveling this week and for the 4th of July, and there were lots with the, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are endowed by their creator, the preamble. No one's read beyond that, and here's the funny thing is that most politically literate English people in 1776 would have read that preamble. There was an aristocracy in England. Most of them read that preamble and said, yeah, so what? We completely agree with this. What we don't agree with is that this present train of abuses and injuries and usurpations that you are attributing to the king is a plot to enslave you. The grievances are where the argument was for a lot of people in America. So no, people just don't read, and I think that's deeply disappointing as a historian at Geneseo. I have to sort of assume in my classes on the Revolution that students have no previous knowledge of the Revolution at all.
A Twitter user named Darren warned NPR, "Keep tweeting this, and this is why you're going to get defunded." Okay, Darren. It's just the Declaration of Independence, man.
Which is not to say that it isn't anti-Trump.
Let's get there later in the hour before we open up that can. I understand that sentiment. We're going to get there coming up here. I want to ask Kevin Mawison to kind of weigh in on some of what you just heard Professor Oberg saying, that he assumes his students at the college level are not going to be aware of the Declaration. You know, you're a social studies scholar. This is an important issue for you. What's going on in classes?
Right. So I'm not surprised either. There's been 100 years or more of punditry suggesting how little Americans know about American history. So the idea that people don't know discrete details about a particular document, important as that document is not especially surprising. I think another thing that probably happened in the case of the NPR tweets is that folks who are writing those tweets have a sort of conceptual framework for what NPR is and what NPR does. I mean, they may see NPR as a sort of, liberal institution, perhaps. So anything that comes out of that is conceptualized by the fact that, NPR is a liberal institution. So they may not even recognize what it is they're reading because of that conceptual framework. So, I mean, in history classrooms, the Declaration of Independence absolutely is taught. The question then becomes is how is it taught? To what extent is it taught? If you look at state content standards across the country, I don't know of a set of state content standards that does not explicitly mention teaching the Declaration of Independence and the importance of that document, but most of them don't prescribe anything beyond the Declaration of Independence needs to be taught. And then, all sorts of things happen in schools and classrooms around the teaching of the Declaration of Independence. In some circumstances, you have sort of a collective memory approach, like it's important for all Americans to know what the Declaration of Independence is. And then in other circumstances, you have a sort of more, critical approach where, the teachers might ask questions along the lines of, do the framers justify, or how do the writers of the Declaration of Independence or the signers of the Declaration of Independence justify the grievances they have, which is different than you need to memorize the preamble because you're going to memorize the preamble because Americans should memorize the preamble, which is actually kind of ridiculous.
So do you agree then, generally speaking, broadly in this country, there's an overemphasis on the preamble?
Yeah. And I think, again, it fits within that sort of collective memory approach to history, i.e., there are things that all Americans need to know as Americans because it's part of our sort of cultural literacy, and particular elements of the Declaration of Independence, explicitly the preamble, is part of that thing. So when people are shocked that they don't know what the Declaration of Independence is when they see it, I think that's one of the forces at work. It's the force of sort of cultural literacy. What do you mean you're an American and you don't know the preamble word for word?
Yeah, some of the people who were attacking NPR on Twitter last week were going, whoa. I mean, all men are created equal. We hold these truths to be self-evident. That's what the Declaration is. The rest of this stuff is explosive. What are you doing here?
Right, exactly.
As opposed to saying, how much have you read of the Declaration? Sam, for you, as a 7th and 8th grade teacher in the Rochester City School District, what does this episode say to you and how does it relate to the work that you do?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of if it's being taught, because it is. It's actually one of the four required texts in Common Core curriculum. Can anybody guess the other three? It's all historical, in that same historical vein. If you have the preamble, Bill of Rights, and President Lincoln's second inaugural address. So the question is how it's being taught. What critical thinking can it access in students? And I think there needs to be a balance between content and critical thinking, because without it, you don't have any context for what it is. So critical thinking is all about proof and argument, and I think without the basic facts of the Declaration of Independence, what does it actually say, there can't be that critical access which may, later in life provide information as you see.
All right. Professor Oberg, you want to jump into that too?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because it seems there's always been a tension in American society between history as part of a civic education. These are the things you need to know to function as a citizen. And then history as an academic discipline, which is the critical skills, right? The study of continuity and change measured across time and space and people, institutions, and cultures. And those two goals can't always be pursued harmoniously, right? That sometimes when looking at the evidence, you have to uncover some pretty unsavory parts of the story, and you have to talk about them. There's always been that tension. There always will be that tension.
Let me turn to Evie Fanning, who, again, was a political refugee from the Soviet Union in the 1990s?
1991.
Right. And so you go back roughly 20 years ago, and you had to prepare for this exam. What do you remember about that experience?
I remember doing a lot of reading in preparation to it. So I read the Declaration of Independence, I read the Constitution, I read the Bill of Rights, I read the dictionary. and I remember being surprised at how difficult the questions were. The one that stands out in my mind is they asked me who were the four presidents killed in office. Do you want me to answer?
Yeah, you certainly can.
Maybe I shouldn't have said that. Let's see. Kennedy, Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley,
yeah.
Right. Oh, good.
You got it.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Based on the current test, which we'll get through in our second half hour, listeners, and you'll see how you do on the quiz, that would have been the hardest one I've seen on recent tests, by the way.
Okay, so that was the hardest one that I remember, okay. And I think it was 10 questions total. There was also a language exam, which was less difficult for me because I'd been in the country for a while at that point. And then there was an oath that we swore in a court with witnesses prior to actually being granted citizenship.
Did it occur to you at the time, or has it occurred to you since, that the work that you put in to get ready for that exam for yourself put you ahead of the average American in terms of actually knowing American history?
I think it put me at a great advantage in general. I don't know if I would have read all of those things of my own free will as a teenager just for a good time. But having read them and having understood them and understood the impact that they have on U.S. citizens, I think is a great advantage. It makes me less afraid.
And let me ask you, and I'll ask all the panelists, and I know some listeners on the phone want to weigh in as we go throughout this hour here, but I'll start with you on this. You know, you mentioned that as a teenager, it might not have been all that compelling or, you know, who knows what we do as teenagers.
Right. There's TV.
As a fully formed adult, you're learning about this. Now, you're learning about it because you have to take the exam for a very a vital reason in your life. Mm-hmm. But are we more apt as adults to kind of soak up and appreciate information? And do we need to do a better job as post-school humans to go back and revisit these concepts and reread periodically and make sure that we are really accessing and familiar with what the founders and the framers were doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I don't know if it matters very much at what point in life we study this, as long as at some point we do study it. So I was about 18 when I was reading that stuff, and it definitely has sunk in. And it's made it so that I'm interested in what else happens. If there's going to be a referendum, if there's going to be an amendment, I want to know about that. Because having read those things, it's become very important to me that I know what my rights are.
Michael, what do you think about the importance of kind of continuing a lifelong education as opposed to just memorizing a few things in school?
Well, I think it's absolutely essential. If you just think of the last few weeks in the news, what you've heard, we've heard the emoluments clause raised in terms of the business activity of the current president and his family. And we've heard references to the 25th Amendment, right, the mental capacity of the president, not taking a position on those, but just saying that discussion's been out there. It's been in the news. And how many people, you know, have read those amendments? How many people really understand the Emoluments Clause? So when you get a talking head on CNN or NPR talking about the Emoluments Clause, well, you can listen to that person and take their word for it, but you really ought, as a citizen, to go back and read this stuff. And look, if you want to go back to what the Founding Fathers valued, one of the things they emphasized was citizenship. And citizenship is more than voting. It's an active engagement. That's why the Founding Fathers, you know, it's why Thomas Jefferson, one of his proudest achievements was the founding of the University of Virginia. Education was essential for the functioning of the Republic. Civic education, humanities education, education in history was essential for the functioning of the Republic. And it seems to me that we've got to a point where that's not valued. We hear STEM, science, technology, engineering, math, and less emphasis on history and the liberal arts, which do have value to the point where, you know, to mention your point, you made a joke about TV. 22% of Americans this is astounding to me. 22% of Americans can identify all five members of the Simpsons family. It's a great show. Less than 0.1% can identify all five freedoms stated in the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, rights that are under assault now in ways that they haven't been under assault in a long time.
I thought you were going to say Supreme Court justices. 5 out of 9, let alone 9 out of 9.
Yeah,
but Simpsons versus Supreme Court justices would also be an interesting one.
Right.
And Kevin, you know, you've taught at the high school level, undergrad, graduate levels. This is this is your work. And can we teach students at every level to not just memorize, to pass a test?
Right.
I mean, I don't mean to be sitting here sort of assailing the whole standardized test.
No, you can.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. sort of.
But I wonder if we are just teaching students that if you got to pass this test, and once you pass the test, whew, you know, you sort of pass that. Can we teach them to become lifelong learners who want to revisit and value civics and citizenship?
Right. Many times that is the only model of history learning that people are exposed to, because once they leave the K-12 institution, many people don't continue on with formal history education. You know, going back to Michael's point, I mean, I agree entirely about the importance of lifelong history and civic education, but I think it also compels us to ask the question, what does it mean to know? Why would we know? And to what ends? So, you know, to sort of give you an example, you know, somebody who can name all 50 states and capitals, but can't tell the difference between the website of a historical association and a website of a white supremacist organization is a lot different than somebody who fails the states and capitals quiz, but is adept at asking whether the establishment of Columbus Day as a federal holiday, for example, says more about the lobbying strategies of Italian Catholics in the 30s than it does about anything that happened in 1492. I mean, those are vastly different ways of thinking about what good history serves toward civic ends, and what good historical knowledge serves toward civic ends. So I'm, you know, unsurprisingly in agreement with the other guests today in terms of the importance of understanding and, you know, doing history, history as a verb, doing history as part of an important civic education, despite the fact that, you know, only a small percentage of the population in K-12 are going to go on to be disciplinary historians and pursue history. You know, it has value for everybody if we sort of do away from the memorizing states and capitals approach and dig more into the importance of things like understanding historical context, corroborating sources of evidence so that you can figure out which one is more credible than which other one, and so on and so forth. There's, I mean, and these ideas are sort of slowly making their way into schools, but largely the assessment battery or the assessment regime is still, you know, your sort of multiple choice questions are primary, and secondary to that is sort of being able to write an essay where you know, take a few details out of some documents, out of context, and, you know, throw them in a five-paragraph essay, and you're done.
I did not know this was going to happen, but this is a perfect setup for what we're going to talk about on Friday in this program, which is if you were designing classrooms and school days from scratch, if this country just didn't exist and school didn't exist and education didn't exist and you were starting over right now with all the technology and opportunity we have, would it look largely the same? Do you agree with Ken Robinson, a British education consultant who has the most watched TED Talk ever, that it would look very, very different? And some of what Kevin is saying sort of just leads me to believe that if we were starting over from scratch, it would be quite different. But that's Friday. I wanted to know if Professor Oberg, of all the examples he could have chosen, he went with Columbus Day. You know, I mean, I looked over at you just to see your reaction over there. But in general, the point he was making, you seem to agree.
Yeah, absolutely. It's tough to... you know, the trick is in getting people to read and getting people to engage things. And I think part of that comes with just imparting a style of knowledge. I've watched my daughter just finish 11th grade in her U.S. history, and it's a lot of it's just copying outlines, memorize and regurgitate in a fairly good school district, a highly regarded school district.
Well, that stuff is easier to grade.
It's easier to grade, and it's not interesting.
No.
It's not inspiring. There's no discussion of context. I mean, I think the Declaration was a big deal in July of 1776, and for the month or so that the news was traveling around the colonies, it was read and announced. But I don't think most people know that the war had begun 15 months before. British authority, to a great extent, was dead by the end of 1774, with the exception of those areas controlled by the British Army. The colonies were doing their own thing. There was a functional declaration in May of 1776 when Congress said, states, form your own governments. You're on your own now. So and really after this initial enthusiasm of 1776 for you know, 47 years, there wasn't much attention paid to the Declaration of it all until Abraham Lincoln revived it with his Gettysburg Address, which ought to be on the list too, you know, if I were designing things.
Read that in English.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, and you should. It's beautiful, but it's you know, so the context and the nuances and the subtleties of history just aren't easily reconciled with the kind of testing regime that I think, you know, teachers have to contend with. We ask teachers to do too much in too little time, with too little reward and too little appreciation, and to cover so much ground in so much, such a short amount of time.
Well, and the phones are going nuts. We're going to get back to you in just a second. I promise we're going to, our second half hour is your reactions to what you're hearing, and we'll also go through some of the questions on the quiz if you want to know how you would fare. Sam, as someone teaching 7th and 8th grade, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the last few minutes about the difference between just memorize and regurgitate, pass the test and move on, versus understand how to really assess history, critically think, apply it. You know, as a teacher now, how do you make sure, or is it a value to you to try to not just prepare students to pass a standardized test?
Yeah, definitely. I think anytime you can apply a significant historical document like the Declaration of Independence to, you know, culturally, to their lives now, you know, pursuit of happiness is a large, you know, theme of that text. So what does that mean? What does that mean for students, especially now? A large portion of my students are refugees, and freedom, you know, they come from all over the world in war-torn countries. Freedom is kind of a new concept for them sometimes. What does that mean for them? How can I apply that to their lives, to their lives in America now? You know, what, because the pursuit isn't really a pursuit, right? It's the promise of happiness. That's what America is. It's the promise, is that you will be free. And so for them, how can they, what kind of things, you know, in their lives are important to them for freedom?
All right, well, I want to take our only break of the hour. Evie Fanning earlier this hour made a point that I want to revisit in just a second, because some of our callers and listeners have said the same thing, that there was that moment last week when some listeners were responding and some Twitter users were responding to NPR, tweeting the Declaration of Independence, assuming that what they were reading was an anti-Trump polemic from NPR. And Evie sort of indicated, well, there's a reason for that. And some of our listeners kind of agree, and I want to get our only break of the hour, and not to get too politically explosive, but I want to hear more of what Evie had to say, some of our listeners. If you're waiting on the phone, Gary, Greer, Casey, Doug, we're coming to you after our only break of the hour as we talk about the reaction to NPR tweeting and reading the Declaration of Independence in full last week. Coming up in our second hour, our guest is Mohammed Saad from Saudi Arabia. He's blind, and he is an advocate and an activist who's worked around the world to make sure people who are blind have access and opportunity. Mohammed Saad has not allowed being blind to stop him from doing things he wants to do, like cooking and using social media sites like Twitter, even photography. How? He'll explain next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our guests, as we discuss the Declaration of Independence and U.S. citizenship tests, you're hearing Michael Oberg, a distinguished professor of history at SUNY Geneseo, Samuel Bovard, who's a 7th and 8th grade ESOL and ELA teacher in the Rochester City School District, Kevin Mawison, who's associate professor of teaching and curriculum and a social studies education scholar and the director of teacher education for the Warner School of Education at the U of R, and Evie Fanning is a local high school English teacher who had to pass this test herself about 20 years ago. And what I want to do is I want to take a phone call from a listener named Gary, and then we'll start with Evie because I think they're on the same kind of thread here. Let's start with Gary. Go ahead, Gary, on the phone.
Hi, Evan, and thanks for doing this. I was really interested when I heard you were going to do this show because at one time I worked as a constitutional rights advocate and just a history buff, especially at this period of time. I'm so glad to hear that people are starting to think about educating people about the founding and what this was really all about. I'm always amazed at the number of people that don't know the difference between the Constitution and Declaration of Independence, that one's an ideal and one's the law. And even the terms that we use today, for instance, you know, what is a founder as opposed to a framer and the difference between liberty and freedom? And we seem to mix these terms up and they mean really different things. And actually, one of the things I'd like to hear your guest comment on is Americans may be surprised at some of the things that in the 28 indictments, the indictment section of the Declaration, that some of the things that we were angry about that we might find shocking today. For instance, one of the things that one of the grievances was that the king had allowed Parliament to pass the Quebec Act, which allowed French Canadians to practice their religion. And although we seem to think that we have this freedom of religion, but one of the things that we were complaining about was freedom of religion in Canada, or that the Parliament was holding up westward expansion into the native lands because we were expanding westward without compensating natives. And I think one of the more interesting ones is that if you remember when we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, there was a lot of controversy about if our troops were accused of committing crimes, that they would be tried there and not brought back. And yet, that's one of the very things that we put in as a grievance, that when British troops committed crimes, that they weren't tried in the United States, but that they were shipped back to England. And although we always talk about taxes, of the 28 indictments, taxes was one of the shortest and only one of the indictments. So again, thanks for doing this show, and I want to hear more from your guests.
All right, Gary, thank you. Well, the first one he brought up, Evie, was on religious freedom, and there's still plenty of discussion today about intended religious bans, things like that. But there's a lot that he had there. So why don't you? I'll start with you, and all of our guests can weigh in.
So really interesting point about the indictments. The one that I was thinking of was that one of our problems was that England would not naturalize more Americans. People couldn't come here and get citizenship. We hate that. We want to be our own country so that we accept refugees and offer asylum, right? There's such disregard, I think, in learning about this and talking about this, and maybe in the current political atmosphere, for the ideals, the founding ideals of why this country was created and for what reason. The word honor appears in these documents. I don't know if we talk about that anymore in our discussions of what's right and what's legal and what we need to do. And so my point earlier was that reality and our laws, the supreme law of this land, as it was written at the time, is now called liberal. That is what is now called a liberal bias, I think. I mean, that's what it's sounding like to me, because when we're talking literally about the things that this country was built for and the ideals that it was built on, and now we're disputing those, right? And if we uphold them, which, by the way, part of the oath that I took is that, you know, in front of witnesses with my hand on my heart, I had to say that I would obey and defend the laws and the Constitution of the United States. So I guess call that a liberal bias, if you will, but I have promised that I will do so to the people in the government of this country who granted me the citizenship.
Professor Oberg, what do you make of Gary's comments?
Well, I'm glad he called, because I think there's a couple of things in these grievances. One of the founding principles of the United States was anti-Catholicism, which the Quebec Act was going to allow essentially people of Quebec, the French, to continue to practice their religion as the caller identifies. Another thing is that these colonists wanted to be able to exclude people. The king was more than happy to send the offscouring of the British Isles here and to allow encourage Scots-Irish settlers to people the frontier. The colonists weren't always happy about being overrun by these foreign hordes. So the freedom to discriminate was a right that many founding Americans wanted. And then he mentioned, you know, the famous last lines that the king has brought the merciless Indian savages down upon our frontier. Without Native American dispossession, the United States doesn't exist. It's as simple as that.
Lots of hypocrisy.
It's not hypocrisy. They were open about it, and they said it. They needed Indian land, and that was it. And they wanted to achieve it, acquire it peacefully, ideally, because that was cheaper to do so. But they were quite open about it. New York couldn't become the Empire State without Indian dispossession. Right, so it's fun. A lot of these principles that we impute to the Declaration, we read out of the preamble. Those indictments show that these Americans who organized the resistance movement against Great Britain had many unsavory traits we would consider very unsavory today.
But go ahead, Evie.
Sorry, but well, the right answer to the question on the civics test about why we came here was in search of freedom. We wanted religious freedom. We wanted political freedom. That's why I call it hypocrisy, because the ideals, which did not match the practice or the laws, but the ideals were honor, freedom, justice, pursuit of happiness.
And then it was pretty selective based on the Declaration. Well, right. You're saying that feels hypocritical to you.
Well, and much of the history since then also.
The colonies existed to enrich the crown. That's from the English perspective, that's why colonies were here, right? You could produce iron, but you couldn't refine it into steel. You could produce pelts, but you couldn't make hats. The colonists were a source of raw material and a market for British manufactured goods. They were supposed to stay in a state of tutelage and pupillage.
And let me ask Kevin Maywison, who made the point earlier that there is a difference between getting students to just memorize facts, between that and getting them to understand history and think critically. What does it say about us? That, because I think Professor Oberg is, and I understand why Evie feels like, wow, we got this hypocrisy going back to the beginning. The idea is that we came over here for freedom and liberty and for however we define that, how narrowly we define that. Not for women, certainly not for natives. This country built on the backs of people like that. What does it say about us, Kevin, that when we actually go back and read the Declaration of Independence in full, many people now not only don't recognize it, but are offended by it? What does that say?
Well, I think it says, first and foremost, that we don't really have a good sense of history as something where you have substantive understandings of stuff that's linked to some way of framing and making sense of them. So, like, the ideas that, you know, we've heard shared among the guests, I mean, these are relatively complex understandings of history, yet fundamentally, there's a framework in which we talk about these things. So I appreciated, you know, Gary's comment at the beginning of his call about the Declaration of Independence as an ideal and the Constitution as the law. That sort of lit a light bulb for me around the question, you know, how does one become two? How does the ideal become the law and what happens in the process? That's a great question, I think, for people who maybe don't even have the depth of understanding that, say, Michael does, for example, to start wrestling with that question. In Michael's response, you know, he talked about the Declaration of Independence as a document that, you know, has an exclusive property to it, like it's designed to sort of exclude people. And so, you know, one question that you could ask, you know, adolescent learners is, you know, how do the foundational documents of our country, how do interactions between people serve to both include and or exclude? And that concept of inclusion and exclusion is a super important concept. It's persistent across American history from the early days to the present. And if we have a concept like that, that we can then sort of hang our understandings of the Declaration of Independence on, one of the metaphors that I always use with my pre-service teachers in my teacher education program is sort of a coat rack metaphor. Like, if we have a coat rack and that coat rack is exclusion and inclusion, and we hang our understanding from that coat rack, it becomes a whole lot easier to access it and talk about it. The alternative is, you know, everybody's been to sort of a holiday party where in the back room all of the coats are thrown in a pile on the bed. And if you don't have a conceptual framework or a coat rack, you're like looking through all of those coats trying to find something that resembles yours. Whereas if you have a coat rack, i.e. like the concept of exclusion or inclusion, then you have something meaningful to hang conversations about the Declaration of Independence from.
And I can't help but thinking, Evie, and tell me if you agree with this here. You know, your feelings about the dissonance between this ideal of what it was supposed to be versus when you actually read the words, and then for you becoming a citizen and saying, I will swear to protect and defend, sounds to me like what you're swearing to protect and defend is the ideal that we sort of never lived up to. And I just want to add, because I think there's some erasure that goes on, and there's this idea that if we don't teach in a hagiographic sense that we're anti-American, whereas I feel like, well, why are we today revisiting a lot of the missteps of history? Why do we otherize? Why do we exclude? Because we don't really want to learn it. That's what I feel.
Yeah, so lots of stuff that I want to respond to there. I think that the Constitution is a document that lays the foundation for people's rights in a good way. I think that knowing the Constitution and knowing the Bill of Rights makes us aware of the things, I don't want to use the word entitled, but like the things that we can count on, the things that we can rely on as citizens, as people who live in this country. And so upholding those, I think, I'm not burdened by that. I appreciate that. I'm glad that I have a responsibility to do that. I mean, I think my point was that these days upholding it and defending it looks like protesting, and that's unfortunate. But I do feel that I have a responsibility to do that as somebody who knows this document and knows the ideals that it was founded on. Now, the history, I think, is a very different thing. And certainly we have, in many ways, a shameful history. You know, we can talk about slavery. I just discovered the Evian Conference, like, a month ago. Why didn't I ever learn about that before, right? Like, why aren't we studying all of the times in history when we have broken those ideals, when we have acted contrary to what the Constitution tells us to do? Ultimately, I think in the history of this country, we revisit those and we try to make reparations for them. We pass laws about asylum, about refugees. But we need to know those things, you know, because things keep coming up, whether because of people's ignorance, which has become like strangely acceptable and almost profitable today, I think, about the history and the laws. We have to know these things because as they come up, you know, if suddenly green card holders are being treated like foreigners, I'm outraged by that, but I'm not scared by it because I know that green card holders are entitled to the protection of every law that citizens are entitled to. And so as long as I live in the United States, where the supreme law is the Constitution and not in Trumplandia, I'm not really scared that kind of thing is going to be a go.
Hmm. Sam, you want to weigh in before we get back to the phone calls? Go ahead.
About what?
There's a lot to chew on there. For your students, are you concerned about anybody who would say, well, if you teach the reality that that's somehow anti-American? I always say, save it.
Right.
I love this country because of the ideals that we have probably never achieved.
Right.
But I would hope to, in my son or his son's lifetime, maybe we get there eventually. That's not anti-American.
No, it's not. And it's difficult. Like I said, like a lot of my students are not born in America. So it's extremely difficult to kind of apply the sensibilities that founded this nation to their sensibilities coming over. But I think it's still extremely important and vital for you know, citizens, even if they're not citizens yet, to know what they're facing. And to know what's, you know, the ideals of this nation and what it can provide for them.
Well, I know listeners have a lot to say because every phone line's filled up. I'm going to go down to Virginia. This is Doug. Go ahead, Doug.
Well, thank you for having me on your program. Boy, there's a whole lot to try to read through there after listening for this time. I guess I just let's bring it back to inside the classroom with a bunch of students, and how then do you teach this Declaration of Independence? One of the things I like to do, the school I teach at is Herndon High School. It's a very religious, ethnic, nationally diverse school, lots of immigrants. And one of the things I like to get them to realize is when Jefferson talks about life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, what exactly does that mean? And what does it mean as far as being an American? Now, these kids, I will then try to say, what's the larger meaning? What's the more philosophical meaning of all that? And I eventually lead them to the idea that, you know, this country is not based on how you look. This country is not based on what your religion is. Look around this room, everybody. You all look different. But because we are a nation of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, that means that anyone can become an American. And that's why, as you look around the room, all the different colors, all the different religions, you all can be an American. I can never become Japanese, but people can become Americans, and that's one of the things that resulted from the Declaration of Independence. So there's little things like that where you can teach students to go beyond just the text. Of course, we look at all the text, and you know, I do teach all the things that were mentioned earlier in the program, but it's a nice way to get people to realize that this country is different, this country is special, and that's important for these high school kids to learn. And then you follow with that up with immigrants, with the units like immigration, where I've taken students to a naturalization ceremony where they can see people become Americans and watch that process take place, and that's very powerful. A lot of the teaching I do, I like to call experiential teaching. I don't just have students learn. I have them experience certain things. I've had over 100 field trips, half as many guest speakers, and I like to get the kids out in the community so they can see how this country really is. Kids have been at Black Lives Matter rallies, all sorts of different things. I took them to Trump's inauguration. So I'll bring them to everything. And I think that, that helps give kids a broader perspective. And if anybody's interested, I've written a book called American Teacher. It's available on mascotbooks.com right now if you want to check it out. And there's a lot of that type of stuff going on in the book. It's a great book for people who might want to be aspiring social studies teachers or for parents to see what really goes on inside a teacher's head.
All right, Doug. Well, thank you for the phone call. The connection flagged a little there at the end there, but I understand, especially the point about experiential learning. I mean, getting out of the classroom is a great thing. Going to naturalization ceremonies should probably be something we all do. Professor Oberg, there are a few things there you look like you kind of wanted to jump into.
Yeah, I guess I would raise the point that, look, you know, much of the preamble of the Declaration of Independence, very few politically literate people in England would have disagreed with that. England abolished slavery before the American colonies did. We tend to idealize the Constitution as well. The Constitution was a fundamentally flawed document, a product of compromises, the most notorious of which regarded slaves as three-fifths of a human being. That aberration was only gotten rid of through a war that killed 600-some thousand American people. These are more than minor burps and hiccups. The notion that this is a country where it doesn't matter what you look like, that would have been laughable to the founding fathers. This is the language that Lincoln reinvented around the Declaration, right? In the Gettysburg Address. But let's not romanticize this. And Constitution itself, and many historians would argue, is the conservative counter-revolution, the Thermidorian reaction to the radicalism of the American Revolution. As many people out there listening likely are thinking, How did majority rule fare in this last presidential election? Well, last two of the last four, we have not had majority presidents. There are flaws in the system. Let's be honest about that. Let's talk about them. Let's understand them. And then it comes back to your point, Evan, where then maybe we can be as good as we would like to be.
I want to make sure we get to a few more phone calls in here. This is Greer in Rochester who's been waiting. Go ahead, Greer.
Hi. I'm just calling to say basically that I wish that more schools would have a class that was just in civics. I was very lucky in my high school. It was a sophomore elective. It was also a senior elective at the AP level. And it was in our history department, but it was specifically on American government, its history, its function, the bureaucracy, how it works. And so you really got an understanding of how things work and within the context. Within that, it also wasn't just teaching to pass a test. You were learning things. You were asked to apply things. So in a unit on the 14th Amendment, we were asked questions about not only how the Brown v. Board cases were decided, but to compare that decision to Bowling v. Sharp, which was also a Supreme Court case in school desegregation, but they used two different amendments to argue them. And why did they have to? The reason they had to was that Bowling v. Sharp was a court case handed out of D.C., and D.C. wasn't a state, isn't a state, so it's not covered under the 14th Amendment. So I'm sitting there 15 years old going, oh, my God, I'm not covered by the 14th Amendment. What does that mean? Brings up a whole other question that are then discussed in class. I'd also like to cap it off by saying that when we look at these documents, we need to remember that the first thing that's said in the preamble is in order to perform a more perfect union. It's not saying that it's perfect, and so that's the imperative to keep working and to keep looking at it. Thank you, and I'll take my comments off the air.
That's the Constitution, not the Declaration.
Okay, yeah. So distinction a bit. But yeah. Greater point about the civics class is
it's a good one.
Yeah. I want to ask Kevin, what do you think about it? She's saying there that hit her hard. That changed things mm-hmm. for her. 14, 15 years old, yeah. But it was an elective.
Right.
And what do you think?
So there's a great deal of variability from state to state in terms of what's required in civics education and history education. So in New York State, for example, there's a half-year senior course. And then, of course, the implication is, well, why is it only a half-year senior course called Participation in Government, which actually provides a great deal of flexibility to those who wish to teach it or who are going to teach it in terms of what it consists of, because there's no state standardized assessment attached to participation in government. So, you know, teachers don't often sort of look at the assessment and say, well, what's required for people to know, and then how am I going to teach it based on that? But it varies greatly from state to state. In some states, there are required civics assessments, and in other states, there's no policy that actually dictates civic education at all. And so it's kind of left to the state and the district to find the resources to be able to make that happen, if it's going to happen. There's an interesting sort of movement, I guess is the right word, I don't know, in social studies education, which increasingly, you know, as Michael mentioned at the beginning of the show, increasingly is sort of marginalized in the school curriculum. There's a movement among social studies educators and education policymakers to lobby for their states to require tests, because if we get tests, you know, the sort of the cliche goes, what's tested is taught. And so there's a sort of a fight in the social studies education community about whether it actually makes sense to advocate for tests that we know are flawed and problematic, just so that it can get some foothold in the curriculum.
Well, I want to read some sample questions on a citizenship test. I promised you I would, but let me ask Sam just real briefly if he's surprised to hear these numbers. Given the population that you teach and the students you work with, this is a survey out of the Center for the Study of the American Dream at Xavier University. They found that 1 out of 3 U.S. citizens fails the civics portion of the immigrant naturalization test. It was a survey of more than 1,000 voting age Americans, and they were asked 10 random questions from the Citizenship and Immigration Services civics exam, which is part of this process. 35% answered 5 or fewer questions correctly. 35%. More than 97% in this survey of immigrants passed the test, which was 6 or more.
Right.
Any surprise to you on that, by the way?
No, not much surprise at all.
Here's where they struggle the most. 85% could not define the rule of law. 75% did not know the function of the judicial branch. 71% were unable to identify the Constitution as the supreme law of the land. 63% could not name even one of their state's senators. 62% did not know the name of the Speaker of the House. 62% could not identify the governor of their own state. 57% could not define an amendment. But here are some of the questions. Again, you got to get 6 out of 10, and I think we've got like 20 or 21 samples here because on recent tests. So, example, and Evie Fanning, in your mind, remember the hardest one for you was the 4 presidents assassinated, died in office, assassinated and killed in office, right?
Right.
That was the hardest one she remembered. I don't think anything is as tough as that on these sample questions. So here we go. We elect a president for how many years? That's one of the questions. And by the way, you get 4 multiple choice. The House of Representatives has how many voting members? Which is not a cabinet-level position out of the following? Secretary of the Interior, Secretary of Communications, Secretary of Energy, Secretary of Agriculture. Who is in charge of the executive branch? Which war was not fought by the U.S. in the 1900s? Afghanistan War, Korean War, Vietnam War, or World War II? What is the name of the national anthem? Which piece of land did the United States buy from France in 1803? How many U.S. senators are there? What is the last day you can send federal income tax returns? Who did the United States fight in World War II? And this question has Germany and Italy, North Korea, Germany, and Japan, Vietnam, Germany, and Italy, or Japan, Germany, and Italy. What group of people was taken to America and sold as slaves? What is the name of the Speaker of the House of Representatives now? Name one state that borders Canada, and they give you Oregon, South Dakota, Rhode Island, and Maine. And then we elect a U.S. senator for how many years? That's just a sampling. Any of those questions as difficult as what you remember?
I totally got this.
You got this.
Yeah, I would pass all over again.
I don't mean to read these questions and sort of laugh. That's not my intention. But, you know, Sam, if your students are doing better than you know, citizens born here, that says that citizens born here, there's disconnect somewhere.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, you know, how much can be attributed to it, but, you know, to a certain level, students born in America kind of feel like they can take that for granted, take basic government for granted just because we live here. They don't have to pass that kind of test, even though they have to pass, you know, tests in school, which, you know, obviously is not sticking with them throughout their lives.
Yeah. And a listener named Ray, and this may be a good way to close this program, Ray said, we live in an extremely vulnerable society. And he sends a long email, but saying the fact that we are this poorly educated, he used the word vulnerable. Michael, what does that word mean to you in this context?
Well, I think it's weakening, and right? And that's sort of an obvious answer. But if we do not if we're not informed, this is the argument of the founding generation, right? An ill-informed public, it makes fit tools for tyrants. If you're not vigilant, if you're not on your toes, if you're not watching, if you're not participating, the freedoms that you've fought so hard to gain can be taken away.
And final thoughts from you. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think that not knowing the precise number of people who are in the House of Representatives is less about vulnerability than not knowing how to tell the difference between different sources of information, one of which is designed to dupe you and the other one is not designed to dupe you. Understanding, you know, how evidence works, I would say that's probably more important than some of the answers to the questions that you asked on the citizenship test.
Yeah, and I would say even on the citizenship test examples, 435 voting members of the House of Representatives, okay, but knowing the function of the judicial branch, that matters more.
Exactly.
You know, so very good distinctions there. Kevin, Michael Oberg, Evie Fanning, Samuel Bovard, wonderful discussion this hour, and I hope we all go back, reread the Declaration, and spend more time on civics as adults. You don't have to be students for this. Thank you, all of you, for being here. I appreciate it. Me too, by the way. I'm going back to read it right now. More Connections next.